often it's implemented with the view to just increase representation with a focus on quotas, but that doesn't necessarily change anything on a structural level. And as well, we have to ask ourselves the question, which women are then able to participate and to be included? Is it maybe often maybe the elites and not actually a very broad spectrum of society?
From the University of Cambridge and the Centre of Governance and Human Rights, my name is Nima Jayasinghe and I'm your host for this episode, and this is Declarations. In this episode, we will be exploring the crucial work of women peace builders in conflict-affected societies, their advocation, mediation, and negotiation of a better future, often without institutional support and at a great personal risk. We will look at how women's participation in peace-building processes highlights how gender equality is fundamental to sustainable strategies of peace and how the comprehensive implementation of the Women, Peace and Security Agenda can transform systems that permit and promote violence. In this episode, I also have with me in the studio Yasmin Homer as a panelist who is doing her final year of a history BA at Cambridge. She'll be helping us lead the discussion. Joining us in the virtual studio for a discussion on the crucial role of women in constructing sustainable peace, we have as a special guest Eva Tabassum from GAPS UK. Eva is the director of GAPS UK, a network of development, human rights, humanitarian and peace-building INGOs. She has worked across Europe and the Middle East, focusing on youth participation, gender and refugee law. Previously, Eva has worked for World Vision Lebanon and the United Kingdom Civil Service. She holds an MSc in Women, Peace, Security from London School of Economics, where she specialized in the interaction between UK's preventing counter-extremism UK's preventing counter-extremism policy and women, peace and security. Eva, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
So to get us started, why don't you tell us a little bit about what GAPS UK does?
Yeah, sure. So GAPS, which stands for Gender Action for Peace and Security, is essentially the UK's Women, Peace and Security Civil Society Network. We're a membership organisation of about 19 multi-mandate INGOs working on peace building, conflict, human rights. and essentially, we were founded to progress the UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which is the WPS agenda. And we our role mainly is to kind of promote and hold the UK government to account on its international commitments to women and girls in conflict areas worldwide, with also a global focus. And we do this by working with our members and then beyond the network membership, which is with our partners, which includes grassroots women rights organisations, civil society and other WPS practitioners.
So Eva, it's really interesting how you've started off by saying that GAPS really like comes from the UN Security Council resolution, which was the first acknowledgement of the impact of armed conflict on women and girls. And I think it would be best to start off this conversation with quite a broad question, so forgive me for that. But I think as we come into the third decade of the Women, Peace and Security agenda, we've still got this question of where are the women in conflict resolution and peace negotiations? And especially now as we're looking at a world where military spending is an all-time high of $2.1 trillion US, and actually in the last 3 years, women's representation in the UN, like in their peace processes, is down 4% from 2020, and now it's only 19%, which shows that in 2020 it was 23%, which is not a great baseline at all. And so I was wondering, what would you sort of say is the sort of big broad answer of why does this problem of implementation keep happening, and what are the different roles of international bodies in ensuring women's participation, whether it's within the UN or bringing up women from grassroots organizations?
So I would say, if I try to narrow it down, I would say that kind of key challenges to implementation of the Women, Peace and Security agenda, or why we've seen such slow progress, is really down to funding, which probably isn't a surprise, sustainable and sustained funding. And then also, I would say, a lack of political will, or just really disengagement with the WPS agenda and its principles. And it, so, for example, if we take funding, you know, one of the main tools, for example, to implement the Women, Peace and Security agenda are national action plans. So most countries have national action plans, most, yes. And then, you know, what we always often find is there's no specific budget tied to that national action plan for any implementation of that activity or those activities that come into that plan. So, for example, for the UK, we've just had the FIFNAP launched. And no budget's been attached. And in fact, we're launching a national action plan in an environment of cuts to ODA, for example. So, and that's what we're seeing globally. And then a lack of political will, you know, we look, for example, at Ukraine and Russia. I mean, where are states meeting their international women, peace and security commitments, you know, as they respond? You know, again, it's always, it's still really siloed in terms of security architecture. It's not really integrated when we look at how we respond in terms of security or foreign policy. And I think that's, you know, that is down to a lack of political will or any kind of enthusiasm behind the agenda.
And so you feel essentially it's kind of become like a checklist exercise that these national action plans sort of need to be out there in policy documents, but whether they actually have a sort of a bulk of funding, as you say, behind them is sort of here nor there for governments and international organisations.
Exactly. It's linked, right? If there's no lack of political will, you're not going to have money put behind it, right? You'll have money cut from it and put to something else. For example, the UK just released their budget allocations for the next financial year. I mean, they've completely cut the conflict mediation office, you know, which is where the Women, Peace and Security agenda sits. So again, and that's indicative of then if there's any political will behind the Women, Peace and Security agenda. So it's very, you know, we need to see full, robust, like, intention to commit the WPS agenda, and with that comes funding, and we need to see that globally.
And so, and to draw out more of your criticisms of the recent National Action Plan, you've talked about how it can't just be siloed in terms of lack of funding, but also it needs to be linked to the UK's current arms obligations as well, to the problem of climate change and migration, and linked to that, the increasingly belligerent attitude to irregular migration. And so I was wondering, so you've talked about how the solutions are essentially a funding and political will. And I was wondering sort of, what do you think the step before that is? I think potentially 20 years ago, we would have said, we just need to have more women in the room and sort of something will come from that. So we've had three female Home Secretaries who've sort of been responsible for crafting this increasingly belligerent attitude to irregular migration. And so what would you say then is the step before funding and political will for the Women, Peace and Security agenda, if it's not just simply sort of getting women in the room and that will happen? Do you think there needs to be a real change in government mentality? Or
yeah, I hear what you're saying. And so women are not, we're not a homogenous group, right? So we're not, doesn't just mean if you're going to have women in the room, they're automatically going to be advocating for like the things that we say we want to see, right? Or what we would say is important to us or needs and priorities. And that's clearly demonstrated by like who you said, the Home Secretary. And for example, like that, and then that even goes into the conversation about what do we really mean by like representation and diversity? Because, okay, it's great having a, you know, it, you know, we have a brown woman who's a Home Secretary, but actually she's doing more harm to brown women. So I don't think that's a win. So there's one thing about representation, you know, that's the main thing of UN Security Council Resolution 1325. It's about women's participation, ensuring that it's meaningful, it's intentional, it's not tokenistic. But, you know, we're operating in patriarchal structures and system, and meaningful participation isn't institutionalized. So, you know, and when we're looking, for example, to select women, and I say the international community to select women to be part of peace process, if you want to talk about peace processes, you know, it's a select few. It's those that are the most vocal or might be the well-connected or might be very middle class or from a certain area. And, you know, it's not diverse. And so when we call for participation of women, it needs to be women in all their diversity, right? With all their intersecting identities. It needs to be a cross representation of, say, the context that you're talking about. And we don't see that. We don't see that at all. And the other thing I would say about women's participation is that it's a structural point. Like, we're talking about a table, right? We say get women at the table, get them at the negotiation table. But what does that table look like? That table's not working. It's not fit for purpose. And everything is context specific. So, you know, we need to really think about, we need to, and this is where we say you need to work with women's rights organisations. You need to work with civil society organisations who are already doing that work on the ground. They know their community best. They know their context best. You know, you should be talking to them about what they, how they see any political peace process talks should look like. You know, there's a lot of it going on informally, but because it's not recognized as formal peace, as part of peace tracks, it's often siloed, it's often ignored, and it's not part of the main architecture, the architecture that's set by the international community. So there needs to be a real rethink of this as well when we talk about participation of women in peace processes and what those peace processes look like. And I think, you know, and often that is, you know, they always, you know, that seems to be ignored when we look back and we're like, oh, you know, we had the 2022 Secretary General annual report last year on women, peace and security, which highlighted those, the fact that we've not progressed, we've gone backwards in terms of women's participation in UN-led peace processes. Like, let's look into that. Why? I mean, we know the answers, the literature's there, but they're still ignoring that, you know, that fact. So I do think that that's got a lot to say, you know, for why we're not progressing at all.
And so that's really interesting about how essentially the relationships between grassroots organisations, national bodies and international organisations are just sort of not there. And as you said, people aren't being listened to by these broader structures who are actually on the ground and sort of know the conditions they're talking about. And so I was wondering maybe if we can take it a bit back and talk about a bit more about your career. And you've sort of traversed all these different levels from your work in World Vision Lebanon all the way up to where you're working now in GAPS UK, and you've also worked in the civil service as a national body. And so I was wondering how have your experiences across these different organisations that are all trying to do subtly different things, how is that currently informing your advocacy as director for GAPS, and more broadly what sort of you think it's told you about the broader picture of women in peace building processes and the agenda itself?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I started my career in law. I actually was, you know, becoming a solicitor, was doing a lot. I was working on in immigration and asylum. So that's the bulk of my work experience before I, you know, found Women, Peace and Security. So I was kind of in the human rights kind of, you know, space, I guess. You know, so there's a lot of skills you learn there, you know, the kind of legal aspect, the legal side of things, thinking about the international law and rights-based approaches. And then and then I ended up doing a master's because I felt like I wanted to just study a bit more and do a bit more learning. And then I found the WPS course at the LSE Centre and applied for a scholarship, managed to get one. And then it was like, wow, you know, this is kind of, you know, for me, coming from a background and my heritage, thinking about, you know, we often have quite a lot of gendered stereotypes and like women's places here and this is what you're expected to do. Like, we almost had kind of a life already carved out for us. And so, you know, I from a very young age, I was always like, but why? Like, no, you know, challenging norms or whatever. So I guess I already had that in me from a young age. And so, you know, when I started studying these course, it was like, okay, so there is an international apparatus that exists, you know, for the participation of women. I'm not saying it's perfect. It's definitely flawed. There's lots of tensions in that. And then, you know, when you have your own principles of like kind of intersectional feminism and decolonial approaches and, you know, all of that. So that's kind of how I got into it. And then, you know, for me, it's very much, and specifically for GAPS, why I like GAPS is that we're very much a bottoms-up approach. We always like rethink. We always think and reflect, why are we occupying space and what are our intentions and how can we facilitate the power or privilege that we have to ensure we can give that space to say, you know, others who are unable to, you know, to hold, you know, hold that space or have that access, whether that's to decision makers. And we make sure that anything that, you know, we do, it comes from needs and priorities of our partners, national partners, our members, you know, really centering their calls, you know, rather than, you know, you know, us being part of that whole kind of structure that's like, you know, top down.
So Eva, just to round off this really fruitful discussion, I think if we talk about a particular case study, so you've talked about how GAPS works as a bottoms-up facilitator of women's grassroots organisations, but obviously that really depends on the situation on the ground for these women. And so an area that's really in the news at the moment is obviously Afghanistan and the complete prevention of women working in humanitarian networks and NGOs. So we were wondering if you can talk to us a bit about how GAPS has navigated this and still try to ensure meaningful participation for these women who are just under a complete hostile environment.
Yeah, of course, definitely. So GAPS has worked in and on Afghanistan for a while now, and we've led quite a couple of consultations specifically as well. When we did the national action, when the UK did the national action plan, we led consultations within country with our Afghan women rights organization partners. So yeah, we've done quite a bit of work. We did the No Women, No Peace campaign, I think it was over 5 years ago. So we've, you know, we've worked quite a lot with WROs and CSOs within Afghanistan, and we still continue to do so. And we worked, you know, we also supported quite heavily in 2021 in August with the evacuation process, and tried as much as possible to get most of our partners out. And, you know, some we managed to, and some, you know, unfortunately, was unable to leave, still there, trying to leave but unable to get out because there's just no functioning safe route. And I don't need to tell you what's happening in the UK with the illegal migration bill and so on. We always make sure that anything that informs the UK's women, peace and security commitments, specifically on Afghanistan, is informed by women rights organisations and civil society organisations' needs and priorities. So Afghanistan is a focus country for the UK. So we, any advocacy, any work you'll see that we've done, it is all done by local WROs and CSOs. And so we continue to do that, and we continue to be guided and led by them. You know, for us, our advocacy at the minute is making sure that the UK government, specifically the FCDO, any response to the situation is done through consultation with them. There's a massive diaspora group, you know, women who fled in 2021 who are here, women rights activists, experts, you know, practitioners, like, who know the context, who know their country, who know how to get things done, who, you know, who should be consulted about how they respond. You know, we advocate that they should be listened to, they should be in contact with them, you know, all the time, and they should be, you know, responding to the situation as they, you know, guide them. We, you know, it is difficult, and you'll see the edict that was put in place in last year, Boxing Day, you know, about banning women from working in NGOs. And then now we've seen the banning from the UN. And, you know, quite honestly, like, a lot of people saw that coming. You know, you speak to Afghan women, they saw that coming, because this isn't Taliban 2.0. It's the same Taliban that was there before. And also, they know how to respond and they know how to deal with the situation because they already had to work in these this environment before. So it's really, you know, it's wild that, you know, they're not being consulted and they're not being spoken to about how they need to tread in this situation. And I think, you know, what's worrying is that, you know, funding is being cut to Afghanistan. And so who is going to be most disproportionately impacted? It's women-led organisations, CSOs, who now are not only able to work because they've been banned, but also, you know, who are also main breadwinners, who are having to stay at home, and they're getting no support from the international community. And so we really need to make sure that we're, like, supporting them as much as possible and emphasising in any negotiations with the Taliban that women need to be able to participate in all aspects of life. And, you know, that's what we need to keep hammering home. And we need to also ensure that, you know, we don't forget those that are still here, who are still stuck in hotels, who are being threatened with homelessness. You know, those Afghan that the worked, you know, that the UK evacuated, that are, you know, many of our partners, they're still stuck in hotels, haven't heard anything on what's next. It's a complete shambles. So, you know, while, so I just want to add that, you know, while we, you know, while we advocate for participation of women rights organizations and civil society within countries, we need to also make sure we're protecting them. And we're also making sure that we provide them with the support when they need it. And Afghanistan was such a big, I say it was a litmus test for the Women, Peace and Security agenda, because, you know, what happened to 20 years of WPS in Afghanistan? You know, it's really, you know, it's a stain, and the international community really needs to reflect on it.
Thank you so much, Eva. That was really insightful. So before we kind of wrap up this discussion today, I was just wondering, is there anything you want to like leave our listeners with, or any kind of messages you'd like our audience to know today?
Just check out the, you know, check out GAPS's work, you know, our Twitter, our social media. We've got our podcast as well. It's called Mind the Gaps. We're on our second episode, and it actually talks about the situation in Afghanistan. And we've got two brilliant speakers on there, Hasina Safi and Mariam Rahmani. So yeah, that's what I would leave with you guys.
Thank you so much for being here today with Declarations. Let's take a quick break now. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Andrea Philippi from Peace Women Across the Globe and the work they are doing to strengthen women's participation in peace processes in Colombia, Nepal, and the Philippines. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to Declarations, and joining us in our conversation today on the integral role of women peace builders in building sustainable global peace, we are joined now by Andrea Philippi from Peace Women Across the Globe to talk about the nuances and relationships formed between local civil society and international bodies. Andrea has worked for Women Peace across the globe since August 2018, from fundraising to programs and advocacy. She has also worked with multiple NGOs on gender-sensitive migration politics, anti-racism, feminist peace work, and gender justice. And she continues to engage as an activist on urban development, feminism, and intersectionality. She has a master's degree in social anthropology and sociology from SOAS and has studied at universities in Zurich and in Palestine. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
To start us off today, we were just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the latest developments in the women's peace work field in your perspective. Just a quick brief overview. Mm-hmm,
sure. I think currently, latest developments, I mean, it's a really vast field, but I think we are facing a global backlash regarding gender issues, and this also shows in feminist peace work, and certainly influences it. We also are facing increasingly shrinking spaces for civil society. And I think regarding the directions we want to take for the future, I think current developments also broaden up a bit and don't focus exclusively on women, but more on gender, also include masculinities, other gender identities and sexualities, and sort of try to center all of that and try to have an inclusive perspective.
And those are really interesting developments that I think we're going to come on to later on in this segment when we talk about your current project, From Exchange to Change. But mm-hmm. if we can just sort of take it back a little bit. And so we opened the podcast talking about how the UN Security Council Resolution 1325 was this big landmark change in its first formal acknowledgement of the impact of armed conflict on women and girls. But we can also think about another landmark, which was in 2005, when the names of 1,000 women from more than 100 countries were put forward as joint candidates for the Nobel Peace Prize. And that's the sort of campaign that your organisation has grown out of. So we were hoping if you could sort of explain to us what that campaign was and how it's informed the work that you guys do now.
Mm-hmm, sure. So that's kind of the starting point of our organization. It was an idea of the president, current president of Peace Women Across the Globe, who saw a lack of the representation of women as Nobel Peace Prize nominees, and decided that it wouldn't be the right thing to just nominate one person, but that so many people across the world are doing so much important work in relation to peace building that it would be an idea to nominate 1,000 women collectively, sort of as a sign for the many, many more women who are working for peace globally. And then she started building a group of people all over the world who jointly looked for women they wanted to nominate. And they built this list of 1,000 women. And out of that, I mean, these 1,000 women didn't receive the Nobel Peace Prize, as you know. But out of this, they decided that it would be really sad not to continue with this really strong network that they formed as part of that process. And so they decided to build the organization that we are today, Peace Women Across the Globe. And how this informs our work today, I think it's an integral part of the organization, because from the beginning, Peace Women Across the Globe had that network of these 1,000 women as the core or the DNA, basically, of the organization. And since the starting point, the organization places a big importance on networking and networks and the exchange of experiences among peace builders and the building of a global solidarity and exchange of knowledge. Yeah, so I think that really informs our work, and we are still continuing to build on that network, to expand it, to have contact with all the people in our network. And also our project work often stems from the network, because we are, yeah, with our partners in the network, we see if we can do project work. Sometimes they have an own organization or they work for an organization. And also we try to include new partner organizations in our network so they can also benefit from that exchange of experiences.
And that's something we can see in the latest program you've been working on, right, which has been From Transition to Transformation, where you've compiled and you formed conversation structures for your partners who are in Colombia, Nepal and the Philippines, and looking at how you can form international networks of knowledge, as you've said, across your local partners. And so I was hoping you could tell us more about why you decided to link these three countries in particular and how this particular project developed. So were there any broad similarities across the countries, despite obviously different societies and gender systems and things like that?
Mm-hmm. Maybe I have to start a little bit before to explain how this developed, because we had like a pilot project that started in 2015, which was called Women Peace Tables. And since 2015, Peace Women Across the Globe organized these Women Peace Tables together with partners, always with the aim of strengthening the participation of women in peace processes. And this was more a campaign-based project with sort of annual events in each country. And after the pilot phase ended, and based on the positive experiences we gained, we developed a longer-term project with partners in Colombia, Nepal, and the Philippines. And this was basically because these three partner organizations all worked on similar issues, and we thought that linking them would be really interesting because they work towards a common goal, and all three countries are so-called post-conflict countries, and they all have formal peace agreements. So we thought that it would make sense, and also the partners thought that it would make sense for them to have, on the one hand, their local projects, but then also on top of that, the exchange of experiences. So actually what the project was, it was called Strengthening Women's Participation in Conflict Transformation in Colombia, Nepal, and the Philippines. And the partner organizations organized women peace tables on a local, regional, and then national level, with the aim of bringing demands from local levels, which could be participants from remote areas, for example, to decision makers at the national level. Maybe I have to say quickly what women peace tables are. So this is sort of a methodology we developed together with our partner organizations, and they aim to create safe spaces where participants can network, they can exchange experiences that they had from armed conflict, and also jointly acquire knowledge about their rights as they are laid down in peace agreements. And then, yeah, like that, get access to information, resources, and networks with the aim of then bringing that to decision makers. So access to information and networks, so people can claim their rights and can influence the structural level as well.
Mm-hmm. And how has that process of transitioning from these local participatory initiatives to more structural processes of transitional justice? What have the mm-hmm. challenges been in making that jump, essentially, and channeling the accumulated knowledge of these women?
This is obviously a really challenging process, and I probably cannot answer that completely, because it really depends on the context. But I can talk about Colombia as an example. So our partner organization, Comunitar in Colombia, is also part of the Ruta Pacifica de las Mujeres, which is a national Colombian feminist network. And through that also connected, or was connected, to the gender working group of the Colombian Truth Commission. Through that connections, sort of our partners Comunitar organized local women peace tables in remote areas. And through their connection to the Truth Commission and the gender working group, managed to establish access for the Truth Commission to people in remote areas. So they, on the one hand, enabled people to learn about their rights that they have as laid down in the peace agreement, but then also enabled the connection to the Truth Commission, and like that enabled that the experiences in the armed conflict of the participants could also be transferred to the Truth Commission. So the Truth Commission recorded testimonials with everyone who wanted to participate. And that's kind of one example where it worked really well to transfer that experiences from people in rather remote areas to the national level. And now their experiences are also included in the final report of the Truth Commission. I mean, collectively, obviously, not individually. Generally, what our partners aim to do is to organize an annual national women peace table where they invite decision makers as well, politicians, etc., and like that sort of enable the transfer of priorities of the participants to the decision makers, and like that hope to influence the structures. And they also do other advocacy initiatives to try to influence, to create influence and transformation on a structural level.
You've just talked about how in Colombia, the really integral role of your partners has been in conveying the experiences of these women to the Truth Commission. And so obviously that's a really meaningful participation on their behalf. But I think reading your publication that has come out of this project, one of the conclusions you do make is how this inclusion needs to remain meaningful and meaningful participation, and not just sort of a tokenistic representation of women and sort mm-hmm. of women are in the room and suddenly something different is produced. And mm-hmm. so do you think there's something potentially integral in this, the broader idea of women, peace and security, that needs to be changed? Or do you think it's actually just the way that, say, national processes of truth commissions and transitional justice or international governments potentially are acting? Would you say, so to essentially sum up a very broad question, would mm-hmm. you say it's more a limitation of the theory and of the field, or of the way that it's being implemented at the moment?
Mm-hmm. I think I can answer that in relation to the WPS agenda, and later I can also share some examples from our publication or some lessons learned But I think in relation to the Women, Peace and Security agenda, I think there are like sort of two things. One is that the agenda has been criticized for example, essentialism with regards to the understanding of gender. So that's sort of something that I feel has to be changed as part of the WPS agenda. There is such a strong, or often there is such a strong focus on women, which is not very intersectional as such. So often it's implemented with the view to just increase representation with a focus on quotas, but that doesn't necessarily change anything on a structural level. And as well, we have to ask ourselves the question, which women are then able to participate and to be included? Is it maybe the elites and not actually a very broad spectrum of society? So that's one thing that I think the WPS agenda has to be broadened in terms of including more gender identities and sexualities. So sort of to also queer the WPS agenda and to make it more inclusive and intersectional, but also in relation to other categories of exclusion, not only gender and sexuality, but also, for example, racialization. And on the other hand, I also think that there often has been, as I already said, a focus on representation and on add women and STER, and this just doesn't change anything. And for example, in relation to national action plans, it's often the case, for example, with Switzerland, and I think also the UK, that there is a focus on including women, for example, in the armed forces. And this is really not the feminist perspective I'd like to see. And I think with regards to the WPS agenda, if we want to still use it and in a productive way, I think we need to recenter structural transformation and center questions of power. And I think then it can be a tool for activists on a policy level to use it to advocate for a structural change and for their goals. But as itself, I mean, I think the important thing are still really networks and movements, and the WPS agenda is only helpful for people working on a very specific policy level, and more grassroots-based organizations might not even use the WPS agenda as such.
Thank you so much, Andrea. That was incredibly informative. Before we wrap up today, I'm just curious about one thing. You mentioned just now that it wasn't so much the feminist perspective that you would like to see. So as a final question, I was wondering, is there anything you'd like to leave with our listeners, or talk a little bit about the feminist perspective that you would actually like to see?
Yeah, I would like that. I would like to see a feminist perspective, actually. It's just that the way the WPS agenda is implemented right now, I feel it's not feminist at all, actually. And what I would like to see personally is an intersectional feminism that is really inclusive and not only includes the like female elites, for example, of a country. And what I would like to share maybe as a takeaway also from our publication and from the exchange with our partners is that it's just really feminist movements and networks are just so important, and they are important already before there is a peace agreement. And also, again, coming back to the example of Colombia, the feminist movement in Colombia has been really strong for more than 20 years. Before there was the signing of the peace agreement. And this really helped in bringing a gender focus actually already to the agreement. And if we have a gender perspective in the agreement, it's just so much easier to then work towards the implementation of that gender provisions. So the Colombian peace agreement is probably the most inclusive peace agreement that we have right now. And this is also because the feminist and queer movements were already strong a long time before the peace agreement was signed. And this is a lesson that we really take away for other contexts, that we cannot, civil society has to be strengthened long before and not at the point of peace negotiations starting.
Thank you so much, Andrea. That was wonderful. And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Those listening, if you do have any questions or comments, please find us on Twitter via @declarationspod or like us on Facebook. You can also send us an email at editor@declarationspod.com. We would love to hear your thoughts on today's discussion. You can also check out our website, declarationspod.com, where each episode and podcast has a companion piece with more information about the episode and additional links and resources. These packages are put together by our show notes writer. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you so much for joining us today. Tune in for more declarations.